Big show to wrap up the week on Friday the 13th. Tom Dudchick checked in with his perspective from the Capitol Report on the primaries in Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven on Tuesday. Gary Rose, Sacred Heart University political science professor, talked about the Democratic presidential debate, the latest one in Texas. Kevin Kelly, GOP state senator from Stratford, stopped by with an update on an ongoing nursing home controversy. My producer Aaron, also not real happy with what happened or didn't happen with the Felicity Huffman and the college admission scandal. And also, late in the show, we caught up with Marilyn Moore, not happy with the absentee ballot situation from the Tuesday night Democratic mayoral primary.
Connecticut has a lot of problems.
Here's the man who will solve them.
Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli.
WICC 600.
And we are closing in on 6 o'clock, Yankee baseball tonight. Don't forget that. Joining us right now for a few minutes, Democratic State Senator Marilyn Moore, coming off a controversial set of circumstances, she says, Tuesday night's Democratic mayoral primary. Marilyn, Paul here. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, Marilyn. Well, we know what happened. I read your release word for word on the air earlier in the program. What is your next step here in challenging, I assume, the absentee ballots here from Tuesday night?
Well, you know, I've got two sets of problems. I've got to document and have affidavits completed on the people who say there are irregularities in their absentee ballot and their voting. That has to be taken care of before we can do anything in the way of filing any. We have anecdotal, we have people who have said, but we're working with our attorneys to actually have an affidavit that we can submit about what transpired prior to the election with absentee ballots.
Mm-hmm.
And then earlier today, I met with the Secretary of State and her staff about what are my options going forward and understanding the process. And I think I'm the type of person who wants to go right to the root of the problem and figure out how do we fix what we've done. If we can't fix it, what are our options? So we feel as though the amount of absentee ballots compared to the number of people who went to the polls is high, and it's not the norm. It may be the norm for Ganem, but it's not the norm for most voting, and I think that we have to go deep based on the complaints that we've heard from people in the community. I owe it to them to do that.
Marilyn, I was just going to ask you, in the interest of time, what kind of complaints were you hearing? Can you give me one or two examples of what made your eyebrow kind of go up and say, something may be amiss here?
Well, we had people early on saying that they were asked to do an absentee ballot long before that they knew they weren't going to be out of the city. And that some people might have been given an incentive to do an absentee ballot.
What do you mean by an incentive?
A $5 gift card or something to that nature.
So Marilyn, just so everybody can get straight on this, so you're saying that there were cash incentives, perhaps, allegedly?
And that's why we want people not to give us anecdotal information, but give us something that they are willing to swear to, that's what happened. All right. So we're investigating them. We're also investigating the high number that might have appeared in some buildings beyond what should have, and how many of those are valid, and how many people actually signed the absentees. We've seen it in the past. The number's higher than we've seen before. So we're just making sure we're checking into that number soon. So it's questionable and it's very high.
Are you confident, Marilyn, that the Secretary of the State's office will do a thorough enough investigation?
It isn't the Secretary of State. It's the state election enforcement.
Yep.
If we get the documentation and we take it to them, I believe they can't ignore it. And so that's what we're working on right now. We've been working on for the next 2 days. But then the other part is I had promised people that I would be on the ballot in November. And I'm looking to be on the ballot in November. I'm not sure what I'll take. I have several options that I'm exploring without putting stuff out there for people to start making the decision on which is the better. But I have some options that I will be on the ballot in November, and that's what I'm pursuing right now.
Do you think you can be elected as a write-in candidate, which, as you well know, has happened before in this state? Do you think that's feasible?
I got all of the details today of what it takes to be a write-in candidate. And, you know, I think at this point, people are so discouraged and disenfranchised and upset. I literally have people come to my house to talk to me about running. I've had people come to our office after we closed. I can't go anyplace without people saying to me, you need to run. I've stayed on the phone for the last 2 days with people asking me to be a write-in candidate. Now, that's the people asking. And I think the people need a place to land, and they need to have somebody that they can trust running the city of Bridgeport. And I think that it's not just about having a write-in candidate, but having the one that they believe is going to fight for them. And I think, I truly believe they see that in me, that I will fight for everyone, regardless of D, R, or U. So it is one of the ways that we can get on the ballot. I haven't made that decision to do that, but I do want to say I will pursue every opportunity that I have and every avenue to be on that ballot in November.
All right, finally, Marilyn, as time is short, have you heard at all, have you had any contact on this from the Ganim campaign and or the Democratic committee here in Bridgeport?
Not one call, nothing. Dead silence.
Marilyn, thank you. Keep in touch. We'll be talking to you in the coming days. Have a wonderful weekend. We appreciate the call.
You too.
Thanks, Marilyn. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Well, there you go. She's going to try. So interesting times coming, shall we say. Want to get a quick call in about that? Got a couple of minutes left. 203-333-9422-333-WIC.
Just a guy who hates driving on the merit, just like you. Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli, WICC 600.
So you're not happy is what you're telling me. Why aren't you happy?
No, that is absolutely
breaking
ridiculous.
News here that's making Aaron Johnson, producer extraordinaire, Aaron's not happy. The news was that Felicity Huffman has been sentenced to 14 days in prison. We'll get more about this coming up top of the hour. She gets 14 days in prison and a $30,000 fine and a year of supervised probation and 250 hours of community service as part of what authorities have called the largest college admission scam ever prosecuted by the Justice Department. Now, when I told Aaron that on the break, his head fell off. He was not happy. You want her to go away for what, 10 years?
No, I don't think she's got to go away for that long, but 6 to 8 months. I mean, I've got...
You're the hanging judge, man.
Oh, yeah.
No, I know what you're going to say. Go ahead.
I've got thousands of dollars in college debt, and I mean, to do what she and a couple other people are at least alleged to done, well, for her, she was sentenced, but yeah. It's a load of crap. You got to do better than that.
Wow. For
2 weeks?
Two weeks.
I could do that standing on my head. 2 weeks? Oh, no. No, that's bad. That's
wow.
Awful.
Well, you're not happy. You're rough. Wow. I was going to say put her away for a couple of months. You know, no. Wow. You want like years.
I say 6 to 8 months. I figure 6 to 8 months.
She's not going to survive.
She'll be all right. She was surviving when she wrote those checks.
Five words. Orange is the new black. She ain't surviving inside more than 2 weeks. Come on, man.
Oh,
a Hollywood actress inside?
I mean, maybe they might really throw the book at her
and
give her 21 days.
I have relatives who work in the prison system. You know what they tell me sometimes? Seriously? Now, this is a federal prison. You know, the women's prisons ain't no piece of cake either. And by the way, Lori Loughlin, Aunt Becky, and her husband, fashion designer Massimo Giannulli, recently pleaded not guilty to their roles in the scheme as well. So Aaron's not happy because she didn't get like 8 years and a $2 million fine, but that's okay.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
You Yeah, that's us right here on your radio at WICC 600, online to WICC600.com. It is Connecticut Today, Monday through Friday, 2 to 6, right here. Your humble servant, Paul Pacelli, with you again till 6. Aaron Johnson on the other side of the glass. Want to get some perspective on primary day and a few other things regarding state politics up next. Old buddy of the show here, he runs the CapitalReport.com, also Capital Report every Sunday, 10 a.m. on News 8, both the website and TV show. Big appointment viewing in the Kremlin, just so you should know. And Tom Dudchick's here. Tom, how are you?
Paul, how are you, my friend? Nice to be with you.
I'm good. Everything good. Well, let's see.
Busy.
Yeah.
Especially in the Park City.
Paul. Yes. Well, let's start with the other two before we get to the meat here. Okay, Tom, so we had no upset in Hartford. We had a big upset in New Haven. And who knows what's going on here in the beautiful Park City. But let's start with Hartford and New Haven. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there were rumblings certainly that former Mayor Eddie Perez, you know, could make a run. You know, we had two different demographics. We had an African American in Brandon McGee, and we who basically they said would be very popular in one end of Hartford for the votes, and then, you know, Eddie Perez, Hispanic, who would be popular in another end of Hartford. Both of those ends of Hartford were pivotal to what Luke Bronin did last time to help him win. So the thought was that maybe one of those two guys may just steal this one. Well, it turned out not to happen. And when you have $1 million in the bank, like Luke Bronin did, you just roll, and he just rolled. And so it was it was somewhat predicted, but you know he rolled to victory, and now he'll roll in November as there's like I think token Republican opposition. I thought he gave a great speech. He was fired up. I mean, he probably would have done better in his run for governor if he showed that kind of passion running for governor. But no surprises there. But there are big issues in the capital city, and a lot of my Republican friends says, well, of course Luke Bronin's doing well. You know, the state's been bailing Hartford out for years, and if they gave the money to Bridgeport and New Haven that they give to Hartford, you know, they'd be doing good too. So stay tuned for that, Paul.
And you know, I was remarking and talking about it here on the show. You knew what Luke Bronin was afraid of there, Tom, because very well-produced TV spots, you saw that. But as I pointed here on the show, Luke Bronin, and I don't mean to be flip by saying this because everybody noticed it, Luke Bronin was the only white guy in the spots. He clearly was targeting African Americans and targeting Hispanics because of his two opponents.
Clearly, and you know the kind of urban people who are moving into downtown Hartford, you know, they tend not to vote in primaries. You know, where you know the ethnic community does tend to turn out. So I think, you know, that was a sharp strategy. And, you know, to govern Hartford, you have to be popular in the ethnic neighborhoods.
All right. Now, New Haven, I, born and raised in the Elm City, still follow a lot of what's going on there. Tom, you know, I really wasn't surprised. I had people telling me, I was feeling out folks I know there. I said, what do you think? And the one thing I heard, Tom, I don't know about you, the one thing I heard leading up to this was something to the effect of, man, there are Elicker signs everywhere. And I think with that big tax increase that she pulled off and all the controversy surrounding, you know, the Board of Aldermen, the Board of Ed there, I'm not surprised that Tony Harp went down. But now she's making rumblings about a third party run.
Well, we'll see. We'll see certainly where that happens. There was supposed to be a quote-unquote unity press conference today at Hartford at 4, and that got canceled earlier this morning due to quote-unquote scheduling conflict.
Yeah, right.
So we'll see how that works. Look, I think the thing in New Haven is this, is that the demographics in New Haven are changing. There's a lot of empty nesters moving back into the city because they want the urban environment. There's a lot of students who have stayed over from Yale. Mm-hmm. There's a real urban culture moving back into New Haven. There's more breweries now open up. There's more hip neighborhoods, and so I think you see a changing demographics from the old time New Haven politics, which was again dominated by a lot of the urban vote, the African American vote,
and the machine,
to basically turn out along with the black ministers to help turn out that vote. And I think it was historic that Tony Harp was certainly elected as the first African American woman to be in New Haven. But I think that when people looked around New Haven, they saw a booming city. They see cranes in the sky. They see things being built. They see energy in the city. They see a new vitalization. It's the only large city that has actually gained population over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But when they look to City Hall, they see FBI investigations. They see people resigning. They see a lot of corruption. They see a lot of things that they don't like. And you know, over the last couple of weeks of the campaign, and Paul Bass, my friend from the New Haven Independent, wrote this great analysis, Mayor Harp, you know, tried to make it a racial issue. She kept saying, you know, he doesn't understand people in our neighborhoods. And there was a thought that Elicker would use drones to basically spy on people in these neighborhoods. And I think it backlashed. I think she played the race card and it backlashed.
You know, Tom,
people just want good government. They don't care if it's black government or white government. They want a government that works.
You know, Tom, and Tom Dubchick is the guest, of course, from the Capitol Report online and on TV at News 8 Sunday at 10. I thought that spot where they singled out, where she singled out, well, he's talked about using drones for public safety. Tom, I don't know about you, but I've talked to a lot of people over the years, and me being a reporter and a talk show host in some of these neighborhoods that are high crime neighborhoods, they probably wouldn't mind something like that. You're right. I think that was an act of desperation by her.
Yeah, and I think that it was an act of desperation. As Paul Bass said in his great column, he titled it "Fear Lost," and I think there was some kind of fear mongering in that in the last couple of weeks of the campaign, and people decided that that's not what they want. That's just not what they want, and they want good government. They want City Hall to row along with the business community in New Haven and build a city that, you know, that can be great. I mean, look, you know, you have a great downtown. You have a built-in population with Yale. You may say that, you know, Yale doesn't pay taxes, but they certainly bring an economic vitality to downtown New Haven, something that Bridgeport and Hartford doesn't have. And so I think they want to make New Haven greater, you know, and I think they think Elicker is the guy that can do that.
Absolutely. Tom Dubchick is the guest. You read the Capitol Report, CT, CapitolReport.com online. Gets like a gazillion hits every day. And, of course, every Sunday, 10 a.m. on News 8, all the newsmakers are there, all the opinion leaders. Give me the money, I'll try, right? Solving, I don't know. It's coming up to 5:18. Tom Dubchick joins us for a couple more minutes. CapitolReport.com on the web, and Capitol Report every Sunday, 10 a.m. on News 8.
Hey, that's a great promo. I'm going to run you up to the Capitol. I think they could probably use you up there if you've got all the answers to all the problems, Paul.
Tom, put me in an office. give me Duff, Arasimowitz, Len Fasano, Themis Claridis, everything. Well, I'll get about an hour or two. We'll have everything done.
Trust me. Done.
Hey, Bridgeport here. Now, we tried to get Marilyn Moore on the show today, Tom. They told my wonderful producer, Aaron, here, they may have some sort of an announcement maybe tomorrow. But you know, Tom, she beat him at the polls. It was only shocking the absentees that made the difference here.
I know. Well, first of all, you know, the whole ballot access, you know, she got the signatures to do the primary, but she needed 207 signatures to get a line for November.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Paul, you standing out in front of the WICC tower, you could get 270 signatures just like over lunchtime.
Probably, yeah.
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 And the fact that she's represented parts of Bridgeport in the Senate, just standing in, just going door to door in those neighborhoods to get 270 should be a no-brainer. I mean, it's clearly political malfeasance. You know, whoever did this should get their political license pulled. I mean, you have to have that fail-safe. Has nobody learned anything from poor Bill Finch, who sat there on the sidelines going, "What? I'm out? I'm out?" You know, so...
When you say malfeasance, Tom, are you saying somebody inside just on purpose or just incompetence? What do you think?
I'm saying, you know, if you need 270, you turn in 2,000.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's just politics 101, blocking and tackling. So, and because I can't believe that they were confident enough that they would win the primary, so they didn't need something. So, you know, so in my mind, that's what really stands out, because everyone thought that she would probably win the machines, and then again, the absentee ballots would come in like they always do in Bridgeport and put whoever needs them over the top. And I was sitting on Channel 8 doing an analysis, and mm-hmm. I had former First Electman Tim Herbst, and he's saying, you know, this isn't exactly why a lot of Republicans don't want to do election reform. You know, early voting and all yep. that kind of stuff. It's because the Democrats have this down. I mean, you can go to school with Democratic politics in Bridgeport with Mario Testa. He can teach lessons on this.
Yeah, man.
And sure enough, the machines come in, she wins the vote, and all of a sudden, lo and behold, the absentee ballots come in, and there you go. And I was getting my phone was in my pocket. It was buzzing every 2 seconds. People saying they're all elated in Marilyn Moore's headquarters, and they're all grumpy and up there at Testo's, and all of a sudden they're feeling better at Testo's, you know, and so and they're all grumpy, they're all depressed at Maryland's headquarters. So it turned on a dime. It's fascinating to watch.
Yeah, and Tom, you know, I agree with you, or at least some of the Republicans. You know, look, early voting, you want to go a day or two or three, that's fine, but when you talk about a week, 2 weeks, a month, no, Tom, with all due respect, my opinion on this has always been, if you let people vote a month out or 2 weeks, or even 2 weeks out, you know what that is? I don't care if it's Democrat or Republican. And to me, that's a candidate protection plan where if anything breaks late in the campaign, they found him with funny pictures with animals. They found he was taking payoffs or she. You can't get your vote back. That's the problem with all this stuff.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, if you have some spare time and nothing better to do, check out how it works in Colorado. It works pretty damn good in Colorado. It's all mail-in. You sit around the kitchen table and you think about your vote a few weeks ahead of the election and you mail it in. If you don't feel like mailing it in, there's drop-off locations mm-hmm. and they have incredible voter turnout. And that's the other issue, Paul. No one's voting in these primaries. I mean, a small percentage of those eligible in Bridgeport who are Democrats actually voted. Same across the state in New Haven and Hartford. So something has to happen to make people want to vote more.
Well, I've had Chris Powell here on the show numerous times for the Manchester JI, and he always breaks it down. When I talk to our buddy Chris, Tom, he breaks it down to two words, civic engagement. That's it. It's got to be civic engagement. You've got to want to do this, right?
Yes, you have to want to do that. And there was a great article the day of the primary that Paul Bass wrote again, and he was another of the changing demographics in New Haven. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of immigrants from Iraq, and he was interviewing some of these Iraqis who were voting for their first time, and they just couldn't believe that nobody votes. And they're saying, this is such a privilege. We've left our country mm-hmm. so we can be part of this, and we registered, and we're voting, we understand who the candidates are, and it was like they were just like smiling the fact that they were actually able to select their leaders.
It's amazing. It's the stuff we take for granted, Tom. Final question here in a couple of minutes we have left. Marilyn Moore, can she pull off a Mike Jarjura from 2005, give out pencils, and run a credible race if she wants to as a write-in?
Yeah, Paul's up there on his research. So you see, it can be done. You can give it, but you know what? It is very, very, very difficult, and especially when you're running against someone like Joe Ganim, who has a well-oiled machine there, and Mario Testo and the Democrats in Bridgeport. I mean, it's a very, very tall order, and you almost have to have this kind of wave of being a mandate, and there has to be a genuine anger among the voters that someone was wronged or things are going the wrong way, and you know, we really need a change to make them actually go into writing. It's very difficult.
Yeah, and the only thing I think that would maybe help her do that is the media coverage of it. Because now, again, how many people are online, how many people listen to radio or watch TV, but to me, that's the only thing that could possibly help her, right?
Yeah, I know. It's very difficult for this to happen.
And finally, as your dog is barking, my last question...
Is
everything okay? You're not having an intruder, are you?
Yes, no.
Oh, okay. When do you get President Trump on the Capitol Report? When's that coming?
Not anytime soon.
Okay. Go see what the dog wants.
It's going in my driveway.
Tom
right now,
Dudchick, so, yeah. I appreciate it, my buddy. Thanks.
Thank you, buddy.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Man. Dog was all over it there, huh? Somebody's in the driveway, as Tom said. So check it out, of course, online, ctcapitalreport.com, all one word, run it together. Basically, Tom started this a bunch of years ago. It is the Connecticut version of the Drudge Report. Even looks like it. And Tom took the model of what Matt Drudge does, just aggregating in very plain script. It's just a bunch of links. You look at it and see what the hot political news is of the day. But then if you want to watch his panel, which is very good, on Sunday mornings, 10 a.m., on News 8, the Capitol Report. All right, and as Tom said, it's could Marilyn Moore pull it off? Well, maybe. The thing that would maybe help her, you would think, that could help here, is the fact that there will be so much natural media coverage of this. If she did have a write-in candidacy, we'd be here doing it on WICC 600. The papers would be all over it. The four big television stations in the state would be all over it. So that might be the only thing that could help here. And plus, she is a known commodity. She has represented a district in the state senate, so it's not like just somebody off the street who did well in the primary that wants to do this. You know, 90% of all this, folks, is name recognition. So we'll see. Once again, we tried to get Ms. Moore on the show today, and they told Aaron, my producer, that there may be some sort of media announcement tomorrow. So we will follow that for you. I'm sure with thousands watching here in Connecticut, the third Democratic debate last night. Did you watch it? What did you think? One of our guest analysts coming on for a few minutes to chat about that. Professor Gary Rose, Dr. Rose, political science professor, author, well-known expert, just from up the road in Sacred Heart University. Gary, how are you?
Hi, Paul. How are you?
Not too bad. Well, Capsule, start us off with what did you think last night from what you watched and read and all the reaction? What are your initial thoughts?
Sure. Well, you know, I think we really observed here just how, I don't want to say factionalized, but how really within the Democratic Party there are two pretty distinct points of view and, orientations, one being more moderate and I don't want to say centrist, but just slightly to the left of center, and the other, I think, very far left, neo-socialist or socialist, if you will. And I would say that that was on display with of course, Biden representing the moderate tone of the party, along with Amy Klobuchar and maybe a couple others that were up there, too. And then, of course, you know, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders being real top contenders there, representing the far left. And so I think you really see it was really more evident last night than I think the previous two debates.
Gary, you mentioned Amy Klobuchar, and I'm reading from what I'm reading and all the political blogs and all the buzz today. She's picked up quite a bit of at least interest off of last night.
Well, you know, I will say this. When I listened to her last night, I was thinking this is definitely Amy Klobuchar's best performance. And she really seemed very sensible and speaking in a way that I think would appeal to the middle of the country, which, of course, is what she represents, coming from Minnesota. And for a short while there, I know she was being known as Heartland Amy. And I thought that actually she had a very good night. And, you know, I started to think actually that we started to witness maybe Amy Klobuchar starting to really have a breakout moment.
Gary, before we went to the break, you used a word that popped up in my mind today, last night, and to a lot of blogs I was reading and hearing from my friends about the word sensible. And you know, Gary, a lot of folks I know, and I'm sure you're hearing this from Democrats or leaning left-leaning or liberal-leaning voters, they just want somebody sensible to carry the party's banner against President Trump.
Well, yeah, there are obviously a very large component of the Democratic Party that does want someone who's going to be able to defeat Donald Trump, and the polls do show that, and that's the reason why, at least in a good number of previous polls, Joe Biden has been leading the pack on that, because a number of Democrats might find him to be, you know, maybe not as sharp as he once was, but at the same time, they still see him as perhaps the most, as you say, sensible, or perhaps, you know, the most electable of the crowd there. Yet at the same time, I will say, Paul, ideological individuals that, of course, that are supporting Warren and Bernie Sanders, they are very motivated, you know, when it comes to caucuses and primaries. And so even though we have polls right now that show most of the Democrats, at least a plurality, that is, you know, not most, but a plurality, do feel that Biden really should carry the torch. When it comes to the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary, then I think, you know, all bets are off the table there in terms of Joe Biden. And I think that anything can go, anything can happen when we get into those contests.
Yeah, Gary, when you look at the polls here, although they vary by a few points, you're right, there has been a consistency where Joe Biden is 28, 30, 31, 33%, right, and then the combination of Bernie Sanders supporters and Elizabeth Warren supporters kind of in an aggregate kind of add up to about what Joe Biden has, everybody else making up about 10%. So, and that's been remarkably steady so far, Gary.
Yeah, it has been. And I think a real interesting story, though, is, you know, as I mean, it really hasn't happened yet, but we're going to see now after this third debate, I think some other candidates are going to fall by the wayside. And the question becomes, where does their small amount of support go to? And, you know, we know that Kamala Harris's support is going towards Warren now, which is one reason why she has been rising in the polls. Mm-hmm. But you know, down the road, I mean, there's no question at all about it that Beto O'Rourke is probably going to drop out. I think he is, and you know, Buttigieg might as well. And, you know, and Andrew Yang. Now, you know, we're talking about individuals that are in single digits, but when you start putting those single digits together, they're going to go somewhere in this contest. And again, once again, you know, by the time we get to Iowa in February, again, many different things can be happening there.
I thought Julian Castro kind of went out of bounds last night with that quip about Joe Biden remembering stuff, and now he's playing CYA today, Gary.
Yeah.
That's not a good look. It's just
not. That was a low blow. That really was. And actually, you know, when they really played everything back, he was not only out of bounds in his personal characterization of him, but he was factually wrong in what Biden had actually said. And so I think that he's probably going to be another one who is probably gone before long.
Yeah, and again, Gary, as you well know, a lot of the people in this race, for whatever reason, it's for future stuff. I mean, you've probably seen the same stuff I have. Beto O'Rourke knows he has no chance, especially with calling for stuff like a mandatory buyback, which to me is confiscation, but that's another argument. But, you know, he's posturing probably for a Senate run after this against John Cornyn.
I think he is, although he has openly, you know, said very clearly, no, I am not interested in running for the Senate. But, you know, hey, when a politician says they're not interested in doing something, you know,
really,
really, you know that there's a real distinct possibility that they're going
to
do that.
Well, Gary, they say not at this present time. Talk to me an hour from now, and I'll give you some. The thing, you know, Joe Biden, that's fascinating. The poor guy's teeth almost fell out last.
Yeah, I know.
Oh my God. Listen, this is a good guy, I think. You know, do I, you know, has he made some screw-ups? Sure. You know, the Neil Kinnock plagiarizing, which I still can't understand. But, you know, Gary, if he were to be the nominee, and look, none of these people are young. Elizabeth Warren, I think, looks good for 70. Yeah. I think she's looking good. But, you know, Gary, I keep hearing from people it doesn't matter, but, you know, would people elect a guy who at his inauguration day would be 78 years old?
I know
that means if he lasts the first term, he's 82.
I know that. Yeah. I think age is an issue there.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, there is such among Democrats and even unaffiliated voters now too, a good portion of them, there is such a strong animosity towards the president. That towards President Trump, that they would be willing to overlook the age of Joe Biden.
Wow. That I know they would. I know. And yet you look at President Trump, Gary, and he got a major win at the Supreme Court yesterday.
Yep.
on immigration, that they can, he can, you know, we can tell now refugees that no, you have to apply first in whatever country you step in before you come here. The economy, right, still is doing okay. There are signs of recession.
Yep.
You know, Kim Jong-un keeps shooting off these lesser arms, probably to keep the populace happy there.
Yeah.
So, you know, you wonder if things are still relatively good, Gary, a year and change from now. Are people going to go and just hold their noses, and when they get, you know, when they scooch down in those little separators and fill out their ballot, is there going to be, much the way there was the first time around, Gary, you and I have read it, is there going to be a hidden Trump vote out there? Well, look, I don't really love the guy, but, you know.
Yeah. I know you have to wonder about that. The one thing that I would be concerned about if I was Trump, though, is that his public approval ratings have not gone over 50%.
Yeah.
And we have never reelected a president whose public approval ratings are below 50%. And his are still hovering in the mid-40s range, which is basically, you know, where they were when he took office.
I mean,
and so that would be concerning to me if I was him.
And the other thing, Gary, before we go to a break here, the other thing that I find fascinating is you still get these, and you mainly see them on TV, the talking heads, the Bill Kristols, the George Wills, Max Boot, Nicole Wallace. You still have this hardcore never-Trumper, right, that is out there mainly in the media. Yet you flip the page and you see that of registered Republicans, he's got 90% approval.
Oh, he's loved within the party.
Well, what is this disconnect between the purists and the rank and file?
I know. The Republican Party is clearly now the party of Trump. There's no question at all about that. And that's why it's really quite interesting to see, you know, some of these Republicans claiming they're going to challenge him in a primary contest, you know, Sanford and others and Weld. I mean, it's just so ridiculous. In fact, the Republican National Committee is considering, you know, canceling and encouraging states to cancel some primaries because they're not even worth, Republican primaries not even, and caucuses not even worth having. And so, no, he has absolutely taken over that party. There is absolutely no question whatsoever about who the nominee of the Republican Party is.
But, you know, Gary, I read a piece the other day from some political statistician who posited this, and he admitted this was an extreme, but he said it could happen. He said, you know, the president could lose the popular vote by 5 million votes next year and could still win the Electoral College. And can you imagine the morning after if that happens?
Oh, my God. I know. Twice in a row.
Right. Imagine that.
That would be amazing. And we've never had that happen.
No. And yet there's, and you know, Gary, yet there is this undercurrent of people, and I know it's not a lot, but it's growing, and of states who, listen, I don't care what party it is, doing away with the Electoral College, that's serious stuff. I mean, you're talking about part of the fiber of how this country runs.
Yeah, and in order to circumvent that problem, there is an effort underway, which I know you know about, you know, called the Compact Plan, where they're trying to get states to enter into an agreement to turn their electoral votes over to the winner of the popular vote, irrespective of how the state voted. And they're trying to stitch together enough states to get 270. And that way, whoever gets the popular vote would automatically win the Electoral College as well. So the Compact Plan is probably one of the most popular, you know, reform efforts underway right now. But they still have a ways to go.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be, they're not going to get the enough states to join into that before the next presidential
contest. No, and again, Gary, the thing that frightens me about that is they're not looking, or they, who the ubiquitous they, whoever they are, they're not looking at the reason this is happening. They see it happening, and they say, well, let's put up this roadblock so it doesn't happen again. But I always say, when it comes to politics, Gary, why is this happening? And they don't, there doesn't seem to be, at least from a lot of people, the admission that what you're seeing, the schism you're seeing here, is a schism, as you well know, between the coastal states and middle America.
Yeah, oh, without a doubt. There are now clearly, very real segments in our society. I mean, we've had it before with the Civil War, of course.
Yeah.
But now it's not North and South so much as it is East and West. And as we say, you know, the left coast, and then of course you've got the coastal states here, all along the Northeast, and then you have Middle America, and it really very. Two very, very different sets of values, without a doubt. And that was evident certainly in the last presidential contest,
too. Yeah. And Gary, finally, what wasn't talked about a lot last night? The economy. It got almost from the candidates and from the questioners. That to me, it's surprising and it's not, but it just shows, you know, how that hangs still over everybody's head.
Yeah, but you know, and it's obvious that to speak about the economy is not to the Democratic Party's advantage, because the unemployment rate is so low, and there's only so much they can say about that. But it's much easier to talk about what's going on with immigration, gun control, criminal justice reform, and it's certainly much easier, as Kamala Harris demonstrated, to look into the camera and berate the president.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get into the economy with the Democrats, they don't have really too many arguments.
I'm hoping, Gary, for another two or three stories this weekend of what the president does with a Sharpie on a hurricane map. That I'm sure that's a real kitchen table issue there, isn't it?
There you go.
Yeah. Gary Rose, Dr. Gary Rose, Sacred Heart University political science professor, author as well. Gary, thanks. We'll talk down the road.
Okay, Paul.
Thanks. Right. Appreciate it right there. Yeah, let's have more of those stories this weekend about what the president's doing with his Sharpie.
If Fairfield County is talking about it, so is Paul. Connecticut Today, WICC 600.
Back to your calls momentarily. First, though, I want to get a quick weekly update, as we do, from Stratford GOP State Senator Kevin Kelly. Kevin, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Yourself, Paul?
Not too bad. And, Kevin, I noticed here, in fact, I was looking earlier in the week, and I had the article pulled up in front of me here. A lot of the media outlets, other than, of course, talk radio, because we've been carrying the water on this so far, are now kind of realizing what's going on here with Medicaid and the nursing home rates, Kevin, that you've been yelling about here. I'm looking at one story here out of the Connecticut News Junkie, and the first paragraph sums it up, quote, "How much did Democratic lawmakers know about changes in nursing home rates before they approved it as part of the state budget?" That's about the capsule of it right there, right?
Exactly. And the fact and the truth of the matter is that they knew quite a bit. It was something that went through committee. It was a bill that the nursing home industry came out and explained to the members of the committee that this was going to have a substantial and negative impact, not only on the industry, but the seniors that they serve and the people that work there. But nonetheless, the committee passed it out of committee, became part of the governor's budget. And even to this day, when we've called for a special session, there has been no resonance. It's not something that the Democrats think they need to fix legislatively.
Now it says
disheartening.
Yeah, it says here in the story, you've probably seen this, Kevin, that the governor's office says there's a process for the nursing homes to appeal the rate reduction if they think it was unfairly applied. And again, the story continues here. The governor sent a letter to Democrats rejecting any argument that the nursing homes didn't know this rebasing of rates was coming. It sounds to me like, Kevin, we have a multiple avenues of CY going on here.
Absolutely. I mean, let's put things, once again, let's go back to the facts. When this story first broke, the governor was amused. He thought it was a joke. Now that joke has become a reality, and he has directed his DSS commissioner to at least give the nursing home industry a reprieve for now. But there's a permanent fix that could be made to help the people in need. And it's called a special session and changing the legislative policy that forced this on the department and the people that we serve. Why the Democrats just aren't going to the permanent fix is mind-boggling. And it's what you say. I believe there's a lot of CYA going on, trying to say that they didn't understand what was going on when they voted for it, which, once again, is an interesting statement. But you know, we got to remain focused. We got to remain vigilant, because I think without the Republicans in the Senate and House, the Democrats really wouldn't be focused on the concerns of the poor, the vulnerable, and the middle class.
Nine nursing homes involved that could end up being damaged or closed down. And Kevin, remind us of the two in this area, one in Fairfield and one in Shelton. Which ones are we talking about again?
We're talking about the Carlton in Fairfield and Hewitt in Shelton.
And what would happen if those homes don't get the reimbursements they need?
Well, this is what the nursing home industry is saying, is first and foremost, you must understand that a Medicaid reimbursement rate is only about 70% of the actual value of the care that's provided. So it's already at a discount. And what's unfair here is that these facilities were told in August that based on statistics in the past that DSS didn't tell them ahead of time, they now are subject to this penalty, and it was retroactive mm-hmm. to July 1. So with the reduction in money, what that means is it impacts the quality of care and their ability to stay in business, and that's where, if we get extrapolate this out, both we lose jobs and these individuals that are serviced by this industry would need to be relocated, whether it's to the home, you know, into the community, or mm-hmm. to another facility. Oftentimes, these transfers are difficult for people with dementia, because anytime you transfer
sure.
somebody, you run the risk of losing capacity.
Mm-hmm.
But also, there's a corresponding cut at the same time in the governor's budget, where he's cutting $7 million from the Connecticut Home Care Program. So while he's talking about reimbursement, this is just like the Special Transportation Fund. He's saying we need tolls for roads and bridges,
yep.
but he sweeps $170 million out of the Special Transportation Fund.
Yep.
Well, he's doing the same thing here. He's saying, I'm rebalancing to allow seniors to age in place at home, so I'm going to cut $5 million out of the nursing home industry. But he also cut $7 million out of home care. And so it doesn't make sense. It's not consistent, and quite frankly, it's just failed leadership.
All right, Kevin, thanks once again. We'll keep tabs on this, keep fighting the good fight on this, and we'll check in with you next week. Have a great weekend. We appreciate it.
You do likewise, Paul.
Thanks buddy. State Senator Kevin Kelly, Republican Stratford.